accession number 23216, reel 2.
Colonel Corbould, reel 2. I was asking you how you were actually assessed and judged while you were going through the training here at Sandhurst.
I think a great deal of it, apart from the academics I had to take, the right, you know, written answers on to questions written on paper and so on and so forth, a great deal, I think, came on the personality side. I mean, if when you were doing a job as a cadet NCO and you started to be a bully or anything like that, you'd have been jumped on. And so, but I don't remember any bullying going on at all, but a great deal of attention was paid to how you were when you were actually in command. I think you were being judged as a potential leader and how you would get on with your men.
Under constant observation.
Under constant observation in that respect, yes, yes.
Who do you think had the most important impact on you? Would it be the colour sergeant or the drill sergeant or the company commander or your platoon commander?
Well, of course, the one person that you saw, the two people you saw an enormous amount of course, was the Commissar Major, the great John Lord, and one's platoon sergeant, or staff as we used to address him, Sergeant Mackay. But they would, of course, report back to the platoon commander, and the platoon commander would have a lot to do with you, yes. He was a man called Robin Wiggum of the Scots Guards, and he was, yes, he watched us all very carefully indeed, and would report back to the company commander. But those are the people, those three, the platoon commander, the staff sergeant, and the commissar major.
How many cadets were there in your platoon?
I must count up in the photograph. I would think there were around about 25. Number 11 platoon, we were, C company.
Did they all pass out?
Yes.
So they did all right then. And what happened then towards the end of the course? Was there a formal parade?
Oh, there was what was then called this day's the passing out parade, which was what it was called, of course, before the war. And we all marched down and you passed out. But mind you, of course, we had to attend other passing out parades before you actually passed out yourself. And of course, as you know, the passing out company up the steps. But no, that was the final parade. And one thing I've always noticed for years at Sandhurst, the band always played when the troops marched off parade, the cadets marched off parade. We always marched off to John Peel. They don't seem to do it now.
They seem to play the Old Grey Mare.
Oh, do they? Yes.
Yes. Yes. But of course, there is no longer the Sandhurst band.
I know. Unfortunately. I know.
It has gone.
Very sad. I know. Yeah. But it was there when we were there.
Did you have a batman while you were?
Yes, which one shared. He was on the corridors in the block.
What did he do for you?
Oh, he did belt. He wear leather belts, highly polished, and bayonet frogs. And he would do those. He would press your battle-dress blouses or trousers and so on. And he would do your boots, particularly if you didn't think you'd done it properly yourself.
What sort of chap was he? Do you remember anything about him?
Yes, I do. He was he'd been here a long time. I never found out that he'd actually served, but he'd been doing this job at Sandhurst for years, a long, long time. I suppose about 30 years, something like that. But they were marvellous people.
When you passed out, did you know what was going to happen to you next? Where
yes.
You were going to go?
Yes, I was told you were going to go to the training battalion at Pirbright. Whither I went on the 13th of September 1941, and when I arrived at Pirbright, I was the youngest officer in the regiment. I was 19 and 3 months old. My two elder brothers, of course, having gone before me.
How were you received when you got to Pirbright?
First thing you were told in the Coldstream, you would never knock on the commanding officer's door. Always called, of course, the orderly room, not the commanding officer's office. And so there you are, 19, terrified, having called everybody sir. there you were, marching from the mess, where you got your kid in there, and told to report to the adjutant as soon as you got there. A marvellous man called Bill Gore Langton, who I saw the other day. Terrifying man. And so down I went, and opened the door, the orderly room, stamped my feet, as I'd been taught to do, saluted, and stood. After about a minute or two, the agent looked up and said, yes, And I said, Corbeld, reporting for duty. Oh, it was meet the commanding officer. Now, this to me was a slight embarrassment, because as you realize, I have got an impediment. The commanding officer, Sandy Strathaven by name, the Lord Strathaven, stood up and shook me by the hand, and he had the mother and father of every stammer, which of course started me going. And I can remember now Bill going out looking, thinking, what on earth is all this about? However, all has been well in the end, and I then went on the young officer's course. I was given 7 days leave.
What was the young officer's course? What did you learn on that?
Well, we all joined up. All my contemporaries at Sandhurst again. And, well, yes, I mean, the first thing was the adjutant's parade every morning at 7:30. And there you were well and truly drilled. You went into the young NCO squad with the young corporals and so on. You would chase around the square. Then you had to go out and drill the platoon yourself, or the squad yourself, which was no problem at all. We'd learned it all at Sandhurst before. We did a lot of field training, and then we got ourselves into carriers. We would drive carriers, rather, Bren carriers. And we would do a lot of toots, and we'd be given a platoon. And you were told you had to know everything about that platoon as soon as you possibly could. And I can remember distinctly sitting down and learning the number, rank, name, religion, home address of practically every chap in my platoon. And on the commanding officer's parade on a Saturday morning, he would go down the line and say, what's his name? And you'd go through the rigmarole. Of course, one or two occasions when one would say to the platoon, whatever I say, you will answer, yes, sir.
Did they play up?
Oh, yes, always, yes. Yeah. The only time that the guardsmen, they were all pre-war guardsmen, and come back, they were reservists, wonderful people. And they would try and play up in the field. Yes. And we were digging a defensive position one day, and I'd received my orders from the company commander, came back, and they were all ragging. There was one chap dancing with a shovel, because they were all ragged dancing that night. But I had to quickly get them under control with the aid of the platoon sergeant. I went, say, because we were on air, but I told them in no uncertain barrack room language, they had to behave themselves.
Where did they come from, these chaps?
Were mainly the north. Mainly Yorkshire, Lancashire, and all that areas.
So within your traditional recruiting
area? Oh, yes.
Area.
I'm very familiar with the Yorkshire and Lancashire accent, and also the Geordie accent, too.
How long did it take you to get to know them and their characteristics?
I loved them. I got to know them very quickly indeed. I enjoy mixing with people, and I pride myself on that. And I would sit them down and have a chat with them, either collectively or individually. And I found that I got their confidence. They would come and tell me about their problems on their own and so on. And certainly later on, particularly when I went overseas, I would write to their parents regularly and get replies back, always.
What sort of ages were these men, the returned reservists?
Oh, I would think between 25 and 30.
So a bit older than you.
Oh, good, yeah, yes, much older than me, yes. And one or two of the chaps on the staff, for example, at Pirbright, there was this wonderful old man called Guardsman Laverick, who had enlisted in about 1918 or 1919, and he treated with great respect.
How long did it take before you had got a grip of them and they had fully accepted you as a platoon commander, do you think?
I think within 10 days. I think within 10 days.
What do you have to do to command that sort of respect and acceptance? What did they look for?
Talk to them. Particularly when you are, we used to march miles, route marches. Well, when it came to the break, you would sit them down and you would go on and talk to them individually or collectively and so on, and chat them up and say, look here, we're getting behind time, we've got to move on. And you would set the pace yourself. Coming back sometimes from over Pirbright Green, I'd stop and have a halt, and I'd buy them all a half a pint of beer at the local pub there, you know. That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I genuinely liked them enormously. I loved them. They were wonderful men.
What sort of man was your sergeant?
Oh, I had a most wonderful sergeant. I can't remember the name of my first platoon sergeant, but after I'd left the training battalion, I was sent to London to the holding battalion for public duties.
Yes.
Which I thoroughly enjoyed. And the platoon sergeants then moved over fairly quickly, because it was a battalion whereby we were feeding the battalions in the desert and and elsewhere. Well, yes. And so one got to know some particular plants better than others. One I do remember very well when I was in the 6th Battalion, called Saint Salmon. And Saint Salmon had been in the 3rd Battalion in Palestine, 1936, 37 time. And he was a wonderful man, taught me a great deal. I remember on one occasion, I thought I knew it all by then. I said to him, we were on a night exercise, and I had my compass out, and he knew I was on the wrong bearing. You're on the wrong bearing, sir. No, I'm not Saint Salmon. So he didn't say any more, and of course I was on the wrong bearing, and I got 7 pickets for that, because I got lost. But Saint Salmon said, you know, I'm here to teach you, sir, you know. And he was a wonderful man.
Did you find that the soldiers were like that too, that they were willing to yield up lessons from their own experience?
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly, yes, yes. They had the most wonderful sense of humour. Wonderful sense of humour. There was never, there was always a laugh every day. And of course, in the platoon, there was always the wag of the platoon, who was the leader.
The duty comedian.
The duty comedian, yes.
You mentioned doing toots. Had you done toots while you were at Sandhurst?
Oh, yes.
You had?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. Sorry, I missed a dot from that particular quick question. Yes, we did toots here. Oh, very, very much so, yes. Mm.
And appreciations, were they part of the...
Yes, we had to write appreciations, yes. Mm.
Do you remember ever having to sketch ground or draw it for reconnaissance purposes?
No, I don't remember having to do that at all. I thank God I could never draw a straight line.
Well, most ground isn't that straight, is it?
It's right.
A wiggly line would normally do better.
That's right.
And you mentioned field training. What were you doing in this field training at the...
At the training battalion,
yes.
Well, mainly, platoon attacks within a company. Mm. Right the way through in these days, it was very brinkered training. Mm. I suppose we did a bit of battalion training in the training battalion, but not very much. I mean, we weren't taught. We were only taught to be company commanders if the company commander subsequently was killed.
Well, there's always that possibility, isn't
there? It is, yes. Mm. But, I would like to have been taught how to command a battalion, basically, because in the First World War, ensigns or subalterns were left commanding battalions.
Well, and in the Second, too.
And the Second World War, too, yes.
There's always a possibility.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And when you were doing these platoon attacks, were they being done according to some form of battle drill?
Yes, it was. The battle drill just come out then. Mm. You know, down, crawl, observe, sights, fire, that's the sort of thing.
Yes.
Sorry. And so, yes, we had to conform to the battle drill, very much so.
How did your guardsmen take to that? Because presumably some of them would have been pre-battle drill and might have been in action in India or in other...
Not in India, no. Some of them had been in Palestine and in Egypt before the war. Oh, they took to it very well. Instilled into them, now look, this is for your own good. Mm. You've got to go down, you've got to crawl along the ground here. Then you've got to observe. And, of course, again, this tremendous business of shooting. We concentrated a hell of a lot on shooting.
Had you done a full course of musketry at Sandhurst, or did that come when you were at the training battalion?
We didn't do a full course. But we were on the ranges a lot. A lot of concentration on firing, and firing straight. In other words, shoot to kill. The pamphlet hadn't been published in those days, as it is now, but the object of the exercise is exactly the same.
What sort of ranges were you shooting at? What distances?
Oh, up to about 300 yards. Mm. Oh, in one case, we had it far at 600 yards, particularly at Purbright.
And was this standard target shooting?
Yes, yes. Mm. And, of course, we had to go into the butts as well and do all the necessary...
How did you get on with the 303? Were you comfortable with the
303? Very comfortable, indeed, yes. After the firing, this Ross rifle, this Canadian thing, which had a kick like a mule, it was wonderful to get onto a 303.
And what about the Bren gun? Had you got the Bren
gun
by that
stage? Yes, Bren gun, yes, yes, yes. That was very good indeed, yes. I enjoyed the Bren gun very much.
Mm. Field training, would that be mainly around and about Purbright on the exercise grounds?
Yes, on the exercise grounds there, yes. And there's plenty of open areas, even still there, but I mean, yes, there was plenty of, in those days, yes. Mm. But we were with the training battalion before I went to London, I suppose, September. I mean, there about 6 weeks, I would think, having done the young officer's course, then sent to London for public duties.
So you were in the holding battalion. So you'd have gone to the holding battalion, would that have been in
about
October?
November.
Okay.
About November 41. And there, of course, in London, one was not able to do very much actual field training.
This is public duties.
Public duties, yes.
What particular places were you on guard then?
Well, Buckingham Palace, of course, we mounted there. And then, of course, I was only an ensign then, so I was the junior officer of the guard.
Yes.
Then, of course, we went down to St. James's Palace. I did one King's Guard, and my brother Peter was the sovereign of the guard, and I was the ensign of the guard, which was quite an unusual thing. My mother was very proud.
Did that give you time off in any...
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, one had more time off in London. Mm. Then, after that, a most interesting thing happened to me. In January 1942, I was sent up to be an ensign on the Chequers Guard, which was looking after Sir Winston Churchill, well, Mr. Churchill, as he was in those days. And that I did for about 6 weeks, which was very interesting indeed.
Did you actually see Mr. Churchill?
A lot. Oh, yes, okay. Yes.
What impression did you get of him?
Oh, I mean, it was like looking almost at the face of Almighty God. You know, we had such enormous faith in him. Mm-hmm. And if he saw you, he'd grunt at you or speak to you. And sometimes we'd be invited in to go and watch the film in the evening. But one had to be very, very careful indeed, because just before I arrived there, there'd been a breach of security. And a chap from MI5 or MI6 had dressed himself up as a Coldstream officer, got himself in to Chequers and got outside the great man's door. And, of course, all hell was let loose. There was a change of company commanders. And at that time, we had to be most careful that everyone who came out from the from Chequers itself, out from the main house, knew the password. And, of course, as a young officer, I was going round a great deal all the time that Winston Churchill was actually there. One evening, I came back to the guardroom and I heard the most almighty row going on. And there, inside the guardroom, were two people pinned against the wall with guardsmen, whatever his name was, with his bayonet pointing at them. And they were campaigning bitterly. One was Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Dudley Pound, and the other was Anthony Eden. And they'd come out from the house, but they couldn't give the guardsmen what the password was. So he was straight inside, quite right. And so I had to sort that one out.
How did you manage to do that?
Well, I said to them, "I'm very sorry, gentlemen, but this guardsman is doing his duty." They were not at all pleased. So I said, "But I will now escort you back to the house. But please, may I ask you in future, you must have the password, else the same thing will happen again." Whereupon I got grunts and almost kicked, metaphorically. And
how many men did you have guarding Chequers?
It was a couple, I suppose.
Up to strength?
Oh, very much so, yes, yes.
There'd be about 150 men in those days.
We probably had about 100 men, I think, yes, yes. I can't give you an exact number. Mm. But there was the company commander, a fellow called John Sparrow, who you may have heard of, who was became the warden of All Souls, Oxford, I think.
Yes.
And myself. And we were the only three officers there at that time, yes. And oddly enough, I met there, I had one of my platoon sergeants there, was a man called Sergeant Davidson, who served with my father in the trenches in the First World War.
You must have run across a number of old acquaintances like that.
Not many.
Joining the family regiment.
Well, yes, but, yes. But he was the one that stands out most.
Yes. And at Chequers, how did you actually go about trying to secure the house? Was there a defended perimeter? Or
yes, there was a defended perimeter. And we had, of course, armoured cars going round as well. Ah. And there was an AKAC battery there, somewhere or other.
So an AA battery. Do you remember how many armoured cars there were?
You know, I very rarely saw them.
Ah.
But they were there. We did know that. But
presumably they'd have been a bit further out.
Much further out, yes, yes. On the extremes of the perimeter.
Do you know who they were?
I've got an idea. They were from a Lancer regiment. Oh. I think so. But there was a similar guard, you see, in the Coldstream, who looked after the royal family,
yes,
called Coates Mission. You may have heard of it. Mm. They, I know, had a Lancer armoured car unit with them. Mm. But I think ours was probably from the same unit. I can't confirm that.
So, I mean, did you have, was the house, the sort of core area at Chequers, was that surrounded by a wire perimeter or anything of that sort?
I don't think there was any wire there at all,
no.
No. But it was continual patrolling in the evenings.
Yes.
Continually going round and round and round, making sense that all the sentries were absolutely alert.
Mm. So you'd have sentries. How many sentry posts would there be around the house then? Do you have any recollection of the number of guard posts?
I would think six.
Six, and then how many...
And they were interdependent upon each other.
Oh, they could see each other.
Or they would meet up with each other because they.
Yes.
And therefore, as an officer going round, one would go to each individual one and draw them together and then send them out again.
Testing the pickets.
Testing the pickets, yes.
And did you have a security patrol? Did you have a sort of security patrol going around as well as the sentries? Or was it simply the sentries going to and fro on their beats?
The sentries going to and fro on their beats, but going around with my platoon sergeant and myself continually. Yes. And we live in the guard room down there. And then, of course, we have our nights off here. We live in a funny little house, the officers, which is a little tiny officer's mess, which is still up there today, go by regularly now.
Do you think that it would have been possible for anyone to infiltrate into the house at Chequers? Was it vulnerable to
it was vulnerable, yes. I mean, even today, a lunatic can get into the Queen's bedroom.
Of course.
Anything can happen. I mean, oh, yes.
No such thing as perfect security, nothing, is there?
No, but it was everyone was absolutely on the qui vive the whole time. Non-stop.
How many people were there living at the house then?
Well, there was a daring lady called Miss Lamont, who was the housekeeper, and she was there permanently. Now, of course, how many people live there all the time? It's impossible for me to say. I mean, there was always a staff of servants under Miss Lamont, and they were all trusted people. And I imagine they'd been security cleared in a big way. Mm. But we were always told when visitors were coming down who they were. I mean, obviously, people like Field Marshal Allenbrook and so on and so forth, who came down an enormous amount.
But the Prime Minister would have been there not all the time.
So no, normally on a Friday he would come down, unless he was abroad.
Yes.
But even when he was abroad, we were all conscious of the fact we were in a very important place, and had to be protected the whole time.
Did you have any intelligence briefings about the sort of scale and type of threat that you were guarding against that?
Yes, we did. We were told that it was rather like what they call it now, Bikini Alpha, Bravo, or Delta.
There were states of alert.
There were states of alert, yes.
Bikini Black, usually.
Bikini Black, yes. But we were very vulnerable to a parachute attack.
Yes.
I don't know about that at all.
Yes.
I mean, there were some good areas for dropping zones up there.
Yes.
But luckily it didn't happen.
Mm. What would you have done then had there been a parachute attack? What was the plan for that contingency?
It's a very good question. But I mean, I suppose we were all allotted to go to a certain position.
Yes.
It would depend on which direction the attack was coming from.
Had you got positions dug? Or,
No, we hadn't. We hadn't got any trenches dug at all, no.
Was there any sort of secure room within the house to act as a kind of citadel for the Prime Minister to...
For him to conduct the war, you mean?
No, for him to go into if there happened to be an attack on the house.
No, not as far as I know. It wasn't like in London where he had this special place. Mm. There wasn't anything, as far as I know, anything like that at Chequers. I mean, the house was rarely sort of open.
Mm.
And he had his map room.
Yes.
And he had his own sort of bedroom and everything else like that in the study. Mm. And we knew where they were, where the windows were.
Mm.
We didn't actually get inside the house, you see.
Yes. But you'd have to know the layout.
Yes. I mean, knew which of the windows were. And we always paid particular attention going around to these windows. And we instilled, of course, into the guardsmen what a most frightfully important job it was that they were doing. I mean, the whole direction of the war, I used to say to the chief, the whole direction of the war is in your hands. And we are in that very important position indeed. And, of course, they were thoroughly enjoying it. They thought it was a well worthwhile job.
Were there any air raids on the...
No, we never had an air. We heard the sirens going in places like Aylesbury.
Yes.
But we never actually had an air raid near Chequers while I was there. And that was from January, I think, to March 1942.
Yes. What happened to you then in March 1942?
I went to the 6th Battalion, which was then stationed at Wanstead in London.
Ah. And
the 6th Battalion was really a holding battalion for going overseas. It never went into battle itself as a battalion. It was a glorified training battalion, really, and everyone got drafted from that.
And what was your duty there? What were your
I was a platoon commander.
Platoon commander.
Yes. We were on... a lot of our work was... we were put on to... the name of the airfield... outside London.
Hornchurch?
No. To come back to me in a moment or two. It begins with H. Not Horton. We put on ground defence. And we were living in a place called Downbarn Farm. And I'm delighted to say that my company commander at that time was Bill Gore Langton, who I'd been terrified of as the adjutant of Pirbright. He made a good deal by then.
He had.
Yes.
And what sort of guardsmen did you have in this platoon? Were they also returned?
A lot of them were reservists, yes. But we were mainly waiting to go to an active service battalion. Mm. And I always wanted to go to the 2nd battalion, because my brother Paul had been the adjutant, and he got rather badly wounded at Longstop Head in 1940, Christmas Day 1942.
In Tunisia?
Yeah, in Tunisia, yes, mm. yes.
Were you able to keep in touch with him while he was abroad?
Not really, no. And furthermore, you see, they wouldn't send brothers who were officers to the same battalion for obvious reasons.
Yes.
And so, I, being the youngest, I suddenly saw myself getting, left out of the war. So I went to regimental quarters. I was a bit cheeky, really. And I said, look here, I want to go to a battalion. You'll go to a battalion when you're told to go. Well, I said, if I can't go to a battalion, so I said to the regimental lieutenant colonel, again, like talking to God, I'll go to the parachute regiment. That did it. I was on the next draft with a most enormous rocket.
A terrible threat.
Oh, I was given a most enormous rocket.
Do you remember what he said when he was giving you this?
Disgraceful. You're a co-stream, you're going to a co-stream, and I'll get you, etc., etc., etc. And he had also been my father's commanding officer in the First War. His name was Guy Edwards.
How long did it take then for you to start going overseas on this fizzer?
I went in not till 1943. I went in May 43. Mm-hmm. I went to join the 2nd Battalion in North Africa. But sadly, of course, the African campaign had ended then.
Yes. And were you in the battalion at Wanstead, the 6th Battalion, until then?
Yes. Then I went back very, very briefly to the Holding Battalion in London to join up with our draft. Yes.
What were you actually doing in your platoon when you were at Wanstead? What was your main activity?
Well, mainly it was training. I mean, again, it was the old, and we were getting even keener on battle drill in those days.
Yes.
I think I crawled over every inch of Wanstead Common with my platoon.
Wanstead Flats.
Yes, that's right.
And was there any significant change in the sort of battle drills you were teaching and in the way in which they were carried out?
No, it was so new.
Yes.
It really wasn't amended.
So it was really getting these drills instilled in your guardsmen.
Like, for example, as I say again, down, crawl, observe, sights, fire. Mm. Never forgotten it.
And was it still basically at platoon and company level that you were doing these?
Yes, we went as a battalion to Lydd Ranges on occasion. And my commanding officer was Colonel Sir Walter Bartlett. And we did a lot of training down there. And I, by this time, had become an anti-tank officer.
Ah, now what did that entail, Dan?
We had 6-pounder anti-tank guns.
Yes.
Which were towed by things called portees.
Mm.
Much less unmanageable things.
A sort of pickup truck.
It's a very large. I've never seen anything like it since.
Yes.
It had a great sort of towing device on it as well. Mm. The guns were towed on there.
Where did you learn about anti-tank warfare?
Did I go into an anti-tank course? I didn't know. Oh no, I didn't go into an anti-tank course. I got to North Africa. When I got back on anti-tanks there in North Africa, did a course in Samara. I never went to Hythe in any course at that stage of my career. I went to Hythe subsequently.
Was this business of becoming an anti-tank officer a matter of choice or a matter of direction?
Direction. I was told you're going to be the anti-tank officer. Yes, yes. And it was very interesting indeed. My platoon sergeant Little was very good indeed, and he had done all the courses and so on. And I learnt fairly sharpish from him.
Did you have an opportunity to actually fire the weapons?
Oh yes, very much so. Yes.
And where did you do that?
At Lydd.
Yes. What sort of ranges were you using there? What sort of distances were you engaging targets? And
I think something like 600 to 1,000 yards. I mean, it couldn't be much more than 1,000. Six pounder wouldn't have gone that.